From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, reaction to the President's State of the Union speech from Democrat.
The challenge for us is not so much whether the President has articulated a vision and an agenda, but whether or not we can take it up and get the work done.
And Republican.
It's about relationships, and this President and this White House have very few relationships in the legislative branch.
Plus, tearing down abandoned buildings while saving historic ones.
Our historic built environment helps us tell the story of not just who we were and who we are, but really informs who we can become.
And we preview this weekend's Ann Arbor Folk Festival as we meet the Appleseed Collective.
The band I really want us to be is a bizarre love triangle of Tom Waits, the Punch Brothers, and Django Reinhardt.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thousands and thousands of buildings are set to be demolished in the city of Detroit. Many argue this is needed in order to revive neighborhoods and the city. But what about historic structures, places with deep-rooted meaning in Detroit? On today's show, we ask, amidst demolition, is there room to preserve history? And then we sit down with the Appleseed Collective, the Michigan-based folk group with a new album out, and we'll get a live performance in Studio East. But first, after President Obama's State of the Union address, we wanted reaction from Michigan's members of Congress. We'll hear from Democratic Congressman Dan Kildee later in the show. But first, we turn to West Michigan's Bill Huizinga, Republican from Michigan's 2nd District. Hello, Congressman.
Hey, good to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. I wanted to start, if we could, with education. President Obama called for more money for early childhood education. Is universal pre-K, preschool for all four-year-olds, is that something you could monetarily support?
Well, when I was in the state legislature, that was something. The 0 to 5 initiatives and the pre-K initiatives were something I think you saw Republicans and Democrats come together on that. The question is one, is that the federal government's role or is that a state government role? The other thing that we need to sort through is, what are we going to offset that with? Where is that money going to be coming from? What other education programs might we use that money from, or is it going to need to come from another department or another category?
So knowing that Michigan has just added $65 million to its budget for early childhood, and of course, under a Republican-controlled House and Senate with a Republican governor, it sounds like that is something that you feel was the right move.
Well, it's certainly a priority. I think, again, as I said, when I was in the state legislature, it was a priority that crossed party lines, because there is so much research that shows if you can intervene early on with kids, and I know this with my own children, you know, the more exposure you can give to them to those positive things early on, the better off we are.
But not federal money?
We'll see. We'll see what the proposal is as we go through this budget process.
Let's go to health care. As the nation knows, the House voted time and time again to repeal Obamacare. And last night, the president said, hey, let's move on. Will that happen in the House, or will there be more votes this year in an election year to repeal the ACA?
Well, I thought it was interesting. That the president really has come to this conclusion that we can't talk about what the ACA or Obamacare needs to be replaced with. I still believe that we have common goals, which is greater access at lower cost and high-quality care. The problem is I don't believe Obamacare and the ACA, the way that it's set up, delivers those three things.
Would you vote to repeal if it came up again?
Yes, I would vote to repeal it, and we need to replace it. I don't think anybody believes that we need to go back to where we had come from. That is not success to me. Whether it's pre-existing conditions and some of the coverage areas that have been explored here, those are all positive things. However, pulling people away further from those medical decisions is not going to make us all better consumers of that medical care. And I think that is a massive mistake that was made when they structured the ACA.
When do you think it is time to move on? When is it time, knowing that the Supreme Court's upheld it, that Barack Obama was reelected? When is it time to move on?
And the House of Representatives was also reelected, and we're going to see what's going to happen here with the Senate. But rarely, if you go back in our history, rarely do we ever have just a vote done and an issue settled. It's always expanding, always evolving, always that we're going to be looking at it. If that were the case, then why are we even talking about reforming Social Security? or Medicare or Medicaid? Why are we talking about what we're going to be doing with the defense budgets? What are we going to be doing with any of these? So, you know, healthcare is not some sort of sacrosanct issue that we can't look at to make sure that we are improving. And if we've gone down the wrong direction, sometimes progress is turning around and going back and figuring out a different path.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with West Michigan Congressman Bill Huizinga about the State of the Union speech last night, where the president, Congressman, talked a lot about income inequality and said he will raise minimum wage for workers who carry out new federal contracts starting in 2015. And then he challenged Congress to do the same for the national minimum wage for all Americans. Do you at all support raising that minimum wage to $10.10, as the president asked for?
Well, it's interesting why $10.10 is the magic number. I know when I was back in, again, state legislature, there was a discussion about having the living wage be $9.25, I think it was at the time. You've got SeaTac out in Washington that's just raised it to $15. Part of the problem is that there is no consensus as to what it could or should be, first of all. Second, I don't believe that it, again, hits the goal and objective. Having a government, whether it's a state or a federal government, come in and sort of just artificially jack up a wage structure is not going to bring greater employment. That is the key element here. We've got to have activity, economic activity, because guess what? If you look at what's happening out in the Dakotas, they don't have a minimum wage debate going on. That's because it's $18 to $20 just to get a job in McDonald's, much less any kind of skilled work and those kinds of things. And what I'm really afraid of is the dad of a 16-year-old and an almost 15-year-old is, where are my sons going to go to get their entry-level jobs? We've got to make sure that we're balancing that all out. The vast majority of people that are in those income levels are people that are entering into the workforce and they're learning how to work. So we need to have greater wage bumps, but I believe that that ought to be the marketplace primarily that is taking care of that.
And yet polls have shown clearly a majority of American voters are in favor of raising the federal minimum wage.
Well, I'm not sure they always think about what the implications of that means. So, you know, those are. If we did everything that was poll driven, we'd look very different, of course. But that was the same thing that happened back in Michigan. There was an increase in the state minimum wage back. I got to think of what year that was. Probably 05 or 06, right around in that time frame. And a lot of that was poll driven. But many pointed out that again made Michigan less competitive and less attractive to our surrounding states for when those jobs were coming into the region.
One of the overarching themes of the president's speech was basically, if Congress doesn't want to work with me, I will move on without Congress. I've got a pen and a phone. In your mind, has the president kind of thrown in the towel on working with your chamber?
Well, he certainly shouldn't. That isn't how the Constitution works, and frankly, it's not the Michigan way. I'm reading a book right now, and I represent part of Jerry Ford's old district, and I'm reading a book right now. It's Write It When I'm Gone. It's all the off-the-record, candid conversations he had post-presidency, and I'm just struck time and time and time again. The healthy respect and understanding that he had for the legislative process and the standing, the constitutional standing of the legislature, as well as the constitutional standing of the executive branch, and how he respected both of those things. And I think what we're seeing here with the president is he is not either fully understanding that or fully respecting it, one or the other. And I think his comments circumventing the constitutional process are counterproductive and the wrong approach. And, you know, if we took more of that Jerry Ford approach, we'd find constructive and respectful ways to work together to achieve results. And ultimately, it's about relationships. And this president and this White House have very few relationships in the legislative branch. And when you don't have those relationships, you don't have trust. And if you don't have trust, you're not going to be able to work through some of those very difficult issues.
That's fair enough, but I believe there are a lot of Americans who would feel that lack of respect for the process exists in members of the House.
I'm not sure how. We continue to pass bills. We've got over 200 bills that are sitting over in the Senate. You know, the Senate leadership has to decide whether they're going to pass those things along. We certainly in the House don't have the ability to either say yay or nay to the presidential appointments. That is a Senate function. They've had their own flurry of activity over there, the nuclear winter that was brought about. And I give Senator Carl Levin credit when it came time to set aside 200 years of of history and the rules of the Senate, he voted no, and he voted to maintain that decorum. But that is something that the Senate has to sort out as well. I think that's a separate issue from whether the House Republicans or the House process itself has an understanding of what the president's role is.
I'd like to get your thoughts on your party's response, Congressman, the Republican response. There were, in essence, three responses to the president's speech. There was the official response, and that was Washington Representative Kathy McMorris Rodgers. Then there was a response from the Tea Party via Utah Senator Mike Lee. And then Senator Rand Paul weighed in with his response. Does having this flurry of messages hurt the party?
Well, it certainly dilutes it to a degree. I mean, you've got the president that has a bully pulpit that has command of the message, and it's going to be a unified message. I think it's interesting to note that there may be some other objectives out there other than getting the party message out from some of those folks, you know, whether they're running for president or whatever their motives might be. Clearly, I think it would be better for the Republicans as much as possible to have a unified voice.
And finally, Congressman, in that 65-minute speech that President Obama gave, did you hear anything you could really get behind?
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, I thought I'm curious to hear more about his MyRA program, exactly, what that means. That is something that I think we're all looking for, is what are some ways to make sure that people are prepared for their retirement, knowing that there's continued challenges with Social Security. And I think probably some of the energy issues, when he said that he wanted to lower taxes for business and bureaucracy to streamline permits, that was something I'd written down. Probably the most unifying moment of the evening, though, was when Staff Sergeant Corey Remsburg was there, and it was so powerful. In fact, I snapped a photo from down on the floor up at him, just because I was so moved by it, and I think it's clear that America stands with those who have served us in uniform.
Congressman Bill Huizinga, representing the 2nd District from West Michigan. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Congressman.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As Michigan cities age and population shrink, some believe demolishing abandoned buildings is essential to reviving these cities and stabilizing the neighborhoods. Take Detroit, for instance. One estimate puts the number of buildings set to be demolished at 10,000. But amidst the tearing down, is there room to preserve historic structures? How do we determine what should be torn down and what's worth rescuing and restoring? To help answer those very questions, Preservation Detroit and the Michigan Historic Preservation Network have just wrapped up a survey of 6 historic areas in Detroit, hoping to bring a preservationist point of view to decisions about blight and demolition. Emily Evans is a preservation specialist with the Michigan Historic Preservation Network. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, let's start with the fact that there is a major undertaking in Detroit right now aimed at tapping into $100 million worth of federal dollars available from the hardest hit fund. And that money is intended for foreclosure prevention assistance. So can you tell us just how that ties into demolition and then specifically preserving historic structures?
Sure. So $100 million came to Michigan from the hardest hit funds. $52 million of that, the lion's share, came to Detroit specifically. The idea with hardest hit funds is that it's to prevent foreseeable foreclosures. That's sort of the terminology there. And the idea is that by strategically demolishing in stable and transitional neighborhoods, key neighborhoods, that you are stabilizing the property values of adjacent property owners as well as the block and the neighborhood, and you're preventing those owners who might otherwise be tempted to walk away from their properties.
I totally get that. So you're trying to put the brakes on that slide that inevitably happens as more and more people abandon their properties.
That's right. And those properties quickly fall into disrepair, as Michigan winters show us is quite mm-hmm. possible really quickly.
I understand that hardest hit funds cannot be used in designated historic districts, but there are eligible historic districts on the chopping block?
That's absolutely right. So when the $100 million came to Michigan, MISHDA determined that designated historic districts, those that are listed on the National Register of Historic Places, mm-hmm. were not eligible for demolition within those neighborhoods, those districts. However, eligible historic districts are determined to be historic And they are identified by the State Historic Preservation Office as being eligible for the National Register, but they're not yet listed. They're not yet designated.
So they could be fair game for demolition.
That's correct.
So the idea then is let's take a survey of these eligible historic districts to see what's worth saving and what's worth letting go?
Sure. So as you mentioned, you know, demolition is a necessary part of what's going on in Detroit and in cities across Michigan and in cities across the nation. There are certainly buildings in Detroit that are a hazard to the community mm-hmm. and that are troublesome and need to come down. However, not everything that's vacant is blighted, and it's an important distinction to make. So our survey aims to survey, and actually as of this last weekend, we have completed our survey.
Been hard at work.
As of this weekend, we have surveyed nearly 19,000 properties. And the idea behind our survey was to ask four key questions that are sort of specific to a preservation perspective. And what this information, what these results are going to be used for is to help decision makers make intelligent, smart, well-rounded decisions about where demolition should take place.
So what were the four criteria?
So the four questions we asked in the field were, what is the architectural integrity of this property? How much is this property in keeping with neighborhood character? Taking a little bit of a macro view and saying, how intact is this block? And then, does this building warrant further research? In other words, a flag question. Is this a little bit more of a unique property that needs a little bit more investigation?
So the idea was these volunteers have combed through these six areas. And what are the areas that
sure.
they're going through?
The six target areas are Grandmont Rosedale, UDM Marygrove, North End, Southwest, Jefferson Chalmers, and Morningside/East English Village. And within those six districts, there are a number of, or six target areas rather, there are a number of eligible historic districts within them.
How much weight will that ruling have, do you think, with the decision makers who are going to decide what gets torn down?
So I want to be clear that we're not making those recommendations. Mm-hmm. As we mentioned, we're giving them that data layer. We're mm-hmm. saying, like, here's a layer of information to help you make those decisions. And that's going to be compiled with other data layers, USPS data, arson data, water data, things like that. But we're confident that our partners and our colleagues at the Detroit Land Bank Authority, the Detroit Blight Task Force, and others are going to take our results seriously and are going to use them as a weight in weighing their decision.
Talk about targeted demolition versus scattered demolition. What's the difference, and how does targeted demolition help neighborhoods in the city?
Well, as the hardest hit funds are intended to do, you know, targeted demolition can take a severely deteriorated property that really is likely to have lost a lot of its architectural integrity, perhaps as a burned out shell, you know, all mm-hmm. of these kind of stereotypical buildings that we hear about and see that really are detracting from, you know, the neighborhood's way of life and quality of living. And you know, targeting those properties is key to stabilizing that neighborhood. But what our goal is hopefully to keep blocks that are intact. Mm. People want to live where there's a density, where there's a sense of community. People don't necessarily, you know, want to relocate, you know, into Detroit, into a sort of thinner neighborhood necessarily.
All pockmarked.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's a sense of integrity and cohesion that comes with an intact block.
Why does preservation matter so much? This is clearly something you speak with lots of passion and it's from your heart. Why does it matter so much?
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, I'll speak for Detroit first. And in my opinion, Detroit is full of architectural character. It is full of just interesting buildings and interesting history. And our historic built environment helps us tell the story of not just who we were and who we are, but really informs who we can become. And so, you know, our historic buildings really matter in neighborhood identity, community identity, and really city identity moving forward. So, again, just because it's vacant doesn't mean it's blighted. And there are plenty of historic properties that are sitting vacant that we need to think more long term about. They're going to be key in helping our neighborhoods and our city move forward. And they deserve to see a new life come back into them.
And this is really lessons that can be applied all over Michigan.
Absolutely. I mean, Michigan's architectural character is stellar.
Emily Evans, a preservation specialist with the Michigan Historic Preservation Network and the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Thank you so much, Emily.
Thank you.
The 37th Ann Arbor Folk Festival kicks off this Friday. This year's celebrated national acts include artists like Iron and Wine and Nico Case, but the festival also features local bands. One band is the Appleseed Collective, based in Ann Arbor. As part of Michigan Radio's Songs from Studio East, Stateside's Mercedes Mejia sat down with the group to talk about the new album Young Love and hear a live studio performance.
You hate to hear the news. I listen to it every day. See the world through rose-colored glasses. Your favorite color is gray.
A revival of roots music seems to be underway in Michigan. Yes, even in this age of iPods and auto-tuned voices. The Appleseed Collective is a band of five young people making a name for themselves by exploring Americana music and sharing it with enthusiastic audiences. And while the instrumentation is traditional, they're taking a new approach to old-time music. The Appleseed Collective is Andrew Brown, Brandon Smith, Vince Russo, Katie Lee, and Ben Ralston. I asked Brown and Lee just what drew them to roots music.
You know, it kind of started in high school. I actually got into things like AC/DC and Guns N' Roses and, like, rock and roll. And then from there, I went back to the blues. And then from there, I went back to pre-war, you know, like the Delta blues. And from there, kind of got more into swing. And then I went into New Orleans. And after spending 4 or 5 days there, I came back up, and that's when this band kind of started.
Well, and it's really interesting because you guys really delve into this traditional music. You have a washboard in the band. How do you make this traditional music relevant to today's audience, do you think?
Well,
we're not trying to.
We're not really playing. We have a traditional instrumentation, but we're not really playing traditional music. It's really hard, you know, when I'm trying to sell the band to someone, I'm trying to describe to them what it is, and I can list a lot of things that are influences, but, you know, it's 2014, and the context is now. And, you know, while I listen to a lot of Django Reinhardt and old Dixieland stuff, I've also listened to Radiohead and lots of different things. So modern music as well. So it's kind of just this amalgam of these influences filtered through me and the other songwriters in the band and all the players in the band. And, you know, I mean, it's not really traditional music. We can't really sell ourselves. We're not really trying to be that.
Right. You say it's Americana, it's jazz, folk, gypsy.
Yeah.
Feels a little bit of
swing.
Everything. Swing, blues.
When people see us, they think we're going to be a bluegrass band, but we really don't play that much bluegrass.
Right.
I almost sometimes describe our band as, or the band I really want us to be, as a bizarre love triangle of Tom Waits, the Punch Brothers, and Django Reinhardt. You know?
That's what it is.
Those are all very different sounding musics. So
I don't feel like we've yet found an audience that hasn't agreed with what we're doing. I think personally our biggest audience has been people who are a little bit older, or at least they get more passionate sometimes than the really young folks. In that, you know, sometimes we do play things like Dinah and Nobody Knows You When You're Down and Out. And people who are in their 60s or 70s or 80s stand up during our set and clutch their hearts. And they haven't heard that in so long. And so it's cool to me that we can appeal to that. We can also appeal to, you know, the festival goers who are in their mid-20s and just dancing crazy for us. So it's interesting.
Once I
That's Katie Lee of the Appleseed Collective singing Nobody Knows You When You're Down and Out in studio at Michigan Radio.
Oh, I just didn't care. Took all my friends out for a good time. Buying bootleg liquor, champagne and wine. Then I'm again solo.
There really is a roots music and Americana music revival happening right now. And maybe it's always been happening.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, I found that babies love our music.
Why
I mean,
is
we
that?
Once were, I, you know, I'm not sure. I think it's just, I don't know. We sometimes busk on the street when we're touring.
Mm-hmm.
And once in New York City, we found this, unbeknownst to us, we found, like, the spot to be, because we were right next to this downtown kids' park. Let me tell you, after about 5 minutes, no one wanted to play on the swings anymore. It was like an amphitheater of strollers around us. And then once one baby walked up and threw a dollar in the thing, and then Vince rings his little ring for service bell every time someone throws a dollar in, so he gets a reaction from the percussionist when they throw a dollar in. It was just like making it rain.
That's Andrew Brown with Katie Lee of the Appleseed Collective talking about their music. Young Love is the title of their newest album. But before we talk about love, let's listen to the song, The Inability to Feel.
The inability to feel, smell and taste, see and hear you. It's what drives me mad. Ragged breath fogging up the glass. It's not about the way you make me feel. Can't be counting cards to see if hearts are real.
Andrew, tell me about this song.
The inability to feel is, in my own personal opinion, the best song I ever wrote, and I don't feel like I wrote it. It was that line, the inability to feel, touch, smell, taste, that sort of idea actually came to me when I was down in Florida and getting what I thought was going to be a massage from a massage therapist, but she was kind of a little bit more of like an energy healer, and I was dating a woman at the time that lived far away, so I was in a long-distance relationship, which is heartbreaking in and of itself. And this lady, I hadn't told this lady this, and she's just, you know, has me on her massage table, and she starts muttering under her breath. And one of the things she's muttering is, the thing that disrupts you is the inability to feel, touch, smell, taste. And I just grabbed that, and that was in my head for a long time. Flash forward 4 months, and that song comes out, relatively fully formed, like plucked out of the ether. So I don't really feel like I wrote it, but, you know, when it comes to the publishing rights, I'm going to take them. And it's kind of about, you know, how you can love someone so much, and then if you get hurt by them so much, you still want them, you're still attached, but you can't actually love them truly anymore. And so it's like you have the problem of the inability to feel, because you can't really feel that you're in love with them, yet you can't really feel that you can go away. And that's sort of a
right. I'm sure a lot of people are saying, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Exactly.
That's the idea.
And I'm curious to know more about the theme of your new album, because it seems like this one is more sentimental than your last. I read this on your website. The band leads its listeners through a narrative of some of love's more cynical chapters, touching on sordid relationships, broken hearts, and eventual loss of love. How did this theme of love come about?
I guess from heartbreak. You know, you kind of, young love is kind of that feeling of like, this is it. And so where are we now past this is it? And that's sort of, young love is kind of trying to tell the story of being there and this is it, and then also go past, we've, you know, past the heartbreak and through the this is it, we're past love now, and almost, you know, looking back fondly on those times, you know, like the old guy in the park watching the school kids walk hand in hand.
So do you feel a little wiser coming out of this?
I feel like I'm an old soul, and I'm getting older.
Young love, a better two in the bowl. A Noah's Ark of unbroken hearts can be hard to keep afloat. And I say, hey, hey, it's young love. You see them walking two by two. But the memories smell like milk and honey. Me, I'm sleeping back to summertime.
The Appleseed Collective is Andrew Brown, Katie Lee, Brandon Smith, Vince Russo, and Ben Ralston. Their CD is Young Love, out from Earthwork Music. You can see the band perform a few songs in studio. Just search for Songs from Studio East on the website, michiganradio.org.
Secret sleep, how large the quarter of tears to weep, and it's a wide knuckle.
with your broom handle sweep. You push me away like I'm the garbage heap. But young love's finest, young love's fire.
And thanks to Mercedes Mejia for that great profile. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Earlier in the program, we heard from Republican Congressman Bill Huizinga from West Michigan. Got his thoughts on President Obama's State of the Union speech last night. So let's cross the state now and the aisle to Democratic Congressman Dan Kildee from the east side of Michigan. Hello, Congressman.
Hey, how are you?
Well, we heard a lot about education and income inequality last night from the president. Very big themes, but not a lot of new initiatives. Did you think there were enough new ideas to tackle the nation's problems?
Well, I think there's enough on Congress's agenda right now that the president has articulated that there's plenty of work for us to do. The challenge for us is not so much whether the president has articulated a vision and an agenda, but whether or not we can take it up and get the work done. So it is true that there may not have been any major new initiatives, but there's a lot of work that we've been talking about, that the president's been pushing for, that some of us in Congress have been pushing for, that the House particularly just has not taken up, that I think in many ways the speech last night was a reminder of the agenda that the American people have sent us to take on, and a call to action to make this year a year that we actually do this work.
Well, then, kind of segueing into that inability to get things on his agenda through the House, what were your thoughts about this strategy from the president, in essence saying, if I have to, I will bypass Congress, use more executive orders, use my pen and my phone? You got Republicans saying it's a bad precedent, constitutionally speaking. What are your thoughts?
Well, I don't think the president intimated in any way that he would use authority that the Constitution does not grant him. There are examples that go back as far as the history of our nation of presidents using the authority granted to them under the Constitution. It is better when Congress is willing to act to strengthen a policy directive, for example. And we would be far better off if Congress were willing to step up and join the president. But we can't base, and I think this is what the president was saying, just because Congress won't do its job doesn't mean he doesn't have to do his job. He has work to do that he was sent to Washington to execute. And he will use, just as past presidents have, the executive authority vested in him by the Constitution.
So flip the coin over. If we see a Republican in the White House, you would be okay with these kinds of policy directives and executive orders?
Well, here's the thing. The Congress plays an important role, a check and balance on the power of the president. And I think it's entirely appropriate for Congress to provide oversight. That's the legitimate role. So I think it's important for us to separate criticism or differences, which is if we were a Republican in office, yeah, I would certainly probably find differences with that person, but that doesn't rise to the level of some of the claims that there are sort of extra constitutional authority that's being exercised. And in this case, there isn't even a specific example that anybody could point to, because the president wasn't specific. He just said, look, I've got a pen, I've got a phone. He could have said, I have a constitution, I have a pen, I have a phone. That probably would have been a little more clear. But you know, the reason that I'm so sensitive on this point, I am a bit sensitive, is that there are some in Congress, unfortunately, that wouldn't recognize any authority under this president. They clearly recognize broad authority granted to past presidents, Democrats and Republicans. But for reasons that are unfortunately all too obvious, there are some in Congress that simply never have accepted Barack Obama as president of the United States. Some of their reaction to his use of executive authority, I think, unfortunately, is affected by that view.
What reasons do you view that, when you say these reasons seem are very obvious, what reasons do you see for this intransigence?
Well, I don't think there's much doubt that because the president is the first African-American president, I'm not suggesting explicit racism, but there is a tone to some of the depictions of this president that I think unfortunately contribute to that thinking. I mean, there are members of Congress right now sitting on the floor of the House who still believe that he is not legitimately, legally occupying the office of president. To me, it's just insane. It's just insane. And that's unfortunately part of the tone that we deal with here in Washington.
I want to switch gears. Knowing, Congressman Kildee, that you represent the city of Flint, which is, as we know, struggling with its murder rate and with violence, and some folks who are really pushing for more gun control didn't feel like the president spoke enough about that issue. Should there have been more focus on gun control, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the issues where he did make a passing reference. He talked about that in a portion of the speech and particularly tied it to the victims of Sandy Hook. But, you know, I'm sure when these speeches come together, they have to make all sorts of judgments about how much they put into the particular speech. I would have liked to have seen an even broader and deeper discussion about the issue of urban communities generally, which goes to the issue of crime, but goes to a lot of other issues. And gun control would be one of those. But, you know, it is... you know, for us, for many of us who feel strongly about those issues, we would much rather see more of the speech devoted to that particular topic.
It was kind of striking because a year ago with the State of the Union, it was right after Sandy Hook, and there was a big, big portion of the State of the Union address devoted to gun safety measures, and very little was actually done. In making such a kind of a passing mention, has the president kind of given up on gun reform, do you think?
I hope he hasn't. I mean, I think the numbers, unfortunately, in the House particularly, don't lend itself to dealing with that issue very effectively. I think that's unfortunate. I hope the president continues to press the point and perhaps uses other venues to do so. Obviously, it would have been great to have a stronger position articulated in the State of the Union, but you know, those are judgments that have to be made by the White House, and I'm sure the president's view has not changed, but unfortunately the willingness of Congress to take this up is just all too weak.
Now, the president never made mention during the actual address of Amir Hekmati, who, as we know, we've covered this story here on Stateside, the Marine veteran from Michigan who's being held in Iran, and you have been working for Hekmati's release. After the president walked down from the podium after the speech, the two of you managed to speak for a moment, and there were reports that the two of you spoke about Amir Hekmati. Did you?
Yes, we did. I've spoken to the president a couple of times now about Amir's situation, and I just encouraged him to continue the fight to get Amir released from Iran and encouraged him to continue the process of negotiating with Iran, because I think that's the two, while they're not directly connected, obviously there's a reason that I would bring those both up in the same context.
Mm-hmm.
And the president reassured me and asked that I pass on to the family that he's on it, that they are not giving up. I had the same conversation with Secretary Kerry, as a matter of fact, just moments before I spoke to the president.
And then finally, I know we all as a nation, I think, really felt moved by seeing wounded veteran Corey Remsburg getting that applause at the State of the Union. But I wondered if you would take a moment and tell us who was your guest last night at the State of the Union.
Yeah, I'd love to. I brought along for the State of the Union Sergeant Cameron Corder, who is an injured Army sergeant injured in Afghanistan. He's recovering at Walter Reed Hospital right here just outside of Washington. And so I asked him to come along, and you know, it was nice to be able to have a constituent here, but also somebody who represents the very best of our next generation and somebody who is willing to, you know, to serve his country and has paid a price for it and is, you know, just as optimistic as any 30-year-old would be. So I was really proud to have Cameron there with me.
Democratic Congressman Dan Kildee representing Michigan's 5th District. Congressman, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
And now, a story of failure from Failure Lab Detroit.
My failure. My failure. My divorce. My failure.
I felt totally bamboozled.
And I thought, this has to end. I can't do this anymore. I can't do this anymore.
Here's poet and mother Jessica Kerr Moore.
When I met my future son, my world was so full of light. In 1995, I moved to Brooklyn, New York to pursue my love for poetry. Within 5 months, my life changed rapidly. I went on Showtime at the Apollo. I won doing poetry. I became an Apollo legend. I signed autographs on the street. For most people, this is the biggest thing that's ever happened to me. But the biggest thing that ever happened to me in 1995, after moving there, after my father passed away, was meeting my son, Omari. Omari was just 3 months old when I met him. His dad, Sharif, became one of my closest friends in New York City. I fell in love with Omari, probably with his dad, all at once. By the time Omari was 3 years old, I was Sharif's girlfriend. We lived in Harlem, and we were preparing to get married. I remember when Omari told me, called me mommy for the first time. He would do it in private when no one else was watching, kind of testing me. He would say, mommy, and I would answer. And I thought that was enough. It was enough for me. When Omari turned 4 years old, Sharif and I had a very large wedding in New York City in the Cloisters. Mommy and Daddy were getting married. I never imagined what being a stepmom was or meant. We never used the term in our house because I was not Omari's stepmother. I was his full-time mother. Omari's biological mother was diagnosed with acute paranoid schizophrenia. And so I took on a son and his dad, and also took on a person who was dealing with the disease in a very up-close way. Because I was a public figure in New York City, oftentimes his biological mother would come out to my shows and verbally attack me, and it was a difficult time. So we decided when we got married to start a peaceful life in Atlanta, Georgia, where I could openly be Omari's mommy, raise him and as my own, and you know, not have anyone question or judge. And what happened after that was something that you never think of when you're a girl in love, because you think you're going to live happily ever after. I never expected to have to fight for my son. But in 2002, my marriage was falling apart in Atlanta, and I decided that I would have to file for a divorce. It was the most difficult decision in the world because I knew with the divorce, it meant that I wouldn't see my son every day. Before I moved to Atlanta, we had a lawyer that told us when we got married that I should file to become Omari's adopted parent, and I should solicit his biological mother for parental rights because I was his full-time mother and I was his full-time parent and caregiver. I wiped his butt, I taught him to read, I saw him to his first day at preschool. As a woman, I didn't want to take away his biological mother's rights as a parent. It is the biggest failure decision of my life. Because I did not legally adopt my son, even though I was his mother, when I divorced his father, he quickly began keeping my son from me. In our divorce papers, there was a paragraph that I wrote that said, the lawyer wrote that said, Jessica has been a mother figure to her son his entire life, and the best thing would be for him to be able to have a relationship with her. And he crossed it out with a pen. Even though it wasn't a legal thing, it didn't matter. And it stayed. The fact that he crossed it out hurt. And if you asked me, this is why I married my best friend, you know? And I never would think that I would ever be in a position where I'd have to use a court to see a child that I'd raised and that I loved. And so the fight began where I would call and want to see my son. And I kept his bedroom the same for a year. And I wanted to tell Omari that I'm sorry. He's 18. And because of the time period that lapsed between he was 9 years old when I left his father till he was about 11, I got pregnant with my first biological son. I cried my first trimester because all I missed was my baby, my first son. And I didn't know how to explain it to people because nobody understood. People would say, you could just have another baby. Or is he really worth fighting for? Is it that deep, Jessica? And there were no books because when I would go to the social science places and psychology, family services places, nobody understood that I love my son the way any mother loved her son. And that paperwork never meant anything to me. So the hardest thing for me now, because as this failure continues to follow me, is that I have, after when he was 11, I was allowed to reunite with Omari. I haven't missed a birthday since then.
13, 14, 15, 16, 17. Now he's an 18-year-old in college, but because of the time period that he was being kept from me so he could be deprogrammed into not being my son anymore, when we talk on the phone, I could tell he doesn't know what to call me. But I'm the only mother he's ever had. And I call, I say, hey, Omari, it's me. You know, I know he knows I'm his mommy, but we haven't been able to quite work that out yet because of the space. And so I feel like I didn't do what as good as a mother as I thought I was, and as much as I tried to be the best mom in the world, because when you're not the biological parent, you have to work extra hard to get the respect that other mothers get naturally. I failed my son by not taking the extra step and doing what would help to protect him and his heart so that he could always have someone I know that he needed in his life. And that was me. This is a poem I wrote for him when I was going through, when he was being kept from me. When I don't write, I break. Glass, throw ceramic cups into walls. I crawl into tight spaces. I hide from myself. How am I supposed to grieve the death of a child that is not dead, just missing from his room, his bed, his life? I don't know how to reprogram myself into not being his mother anymore. It is all I have known of motherhood. I am introduced at his 10th birthday as Jessica. I have not missed one of his parties since 3. I'm asked, why am I late? And I want to say, this time and this public space doesn't count. I want to ask, why haven't I seen my son in 9 months? I say nothing. I enjoy the private time we sneak on the roller skating rink. We catch up on summer camp and how it feels to be 10 as we race in circles. He says he feels different, and he is. It is these smiles and this moment that is genuine. Tonight will be peaceful, I tell myself, crying as we drive away. Depression is loud and ugly. Tonight I will gain control, have faith in the love from my first son, even as the moon comes down on this day. Thank you.
That was Jessica Care Moore telling her story of failure. You can find out more about Failure Lab and hear more stories at failure-lab.com. Stateside was produced and directed today by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer is Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Haddle, Katie Suha, and Claire Tenniskitter. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.